Hello and welcome to the Nourish, Balance, Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. Back on the podcast today is sleep, nutrition and metabolism expert Greg Potter, PhD. Through his academic research and public speaking, consulting and writing, Greg empowers people to make simple and sustainable lifestyle changes that add years to their lives and life to their years. His work has been featured in dozens of international media outlets, including Reuters, Time and the Wokington... The Washington Post, and he regularly contributes to popular websites, blogs, and podcasts. On this podcast, Greg is talking about light, including the importance of getting out in the sun, and also modern problems with artificial light. He discusses the impact of light on the circadian system, along with up-to-date recommendations related to light hygiene. We discuss practical tips for reducing light at night, not all of which involve putting away your device, and why not getting the right kind of light may be keeping you from achieving your body composition goals. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have our eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients. We've saved many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where our scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays covering everything from thyroid to high cortisol. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Greg Potter. Well, Greg, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Yeah, how are you, Chris?
I'm great. Really enjoying spending more time programming a computer and spending a lot of time outdoors still, enjoying the sunshine. We're going to talk about light today. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to prepare for this podcast as ever.
Yeah, pleasure. It's an important subject. And I'm glad that you enjoy programming. I must admit, I don't think I could ever do that and enjoy it.
Yeah, you could. If you've ever done Legos, you've already programmed. It's the same thing.
Interesting. So my girlfriend is an ex-dancer. And she learned to code and just couldn't get to the point where she enjoyed it. She got to the point where she was probably good enough to work in that line of work. And she then went into coaching, software coding, but eventually stepped down from that position and now is involved in talent management because day to day, she just couldn't sit in front of the screen for that long.
So there you're getting at the, I was about to ask that same question. Is it that she doesn't enjoy coding or is it that she doesn't enjoy spending too much time sitting at a computer, possibly in a grey cubicle underneath fluorescent lighting, per se?
maybe.
You see, that's what I feel like has happened now is like you can have your cake and eat it too. Before, you used to have to drive somewhere and sit in traffic and then sit in a grey cubicle underneath fluorescent lights and drink bad coffee. And now you don't have to do any of that, right? You're like kind of free to organize your day in any way you like. So I think coding just got better than ever.
Ah, there you go. Maybe she switched over too early.
Prematurely. So give us an update on what you've been working on recently.
I am still involved in Resilient Nutrition, so still helping them out with some product development stuff. I've been helping a digital health company over here in the UK. They have recently launched a web app and a mobile app too, and I created a module about sleep for them.
That's fantastic. So tell us about them. You can name them. I've got no plan in promoting other people's stuff, especially when they're doing what we would call the quadrant one and two stuff. You know, like they're not trying to sell some peptide or pharmaceutical drug or whatnot, fiddling in the margins. What are they doing?
They are not doing that. The name is Wellix, W-E-L-L-I-C-S. And they are primarily involved in corporate wellness stuff. So they have a series of four different modules spread out over the year. Basically, each of those last 13 weeks. So at each weekly session, there's a brief video about an important subject, including one to three key takeaways that people can incorporate immediately to improve something related to the relevant module. And we recorded the sleep ones a few weeks ago. I think they came out relatively well and really enjoy working with them. Just a really friendly bunch. I haven't actually met any of them in person, in much the same way that I still haven't met you in person, Chris.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? This is your eighth appearance on the podcast, we still haven't met in person.
Yeah, the last few years have been like that, unfortunately. So I'm used to working with people on a regular basis and still haven't met them. So hopefully that all starts to change soon.
I hope so too. Yeah, we're definitely getting back into travel now. All the restrictions have been released. So is this how you get paid for doing quadrant one and quadrant two? I've been wondering about this for many years now. It seems there's a strict separation from things that really help people the most and things that you can make money on. I honestly don't know that many examples of things that do both. And is this the answer then, the corporate wellness app? What do you think about that?
I don't know. I also don't know that I fully understand your question.
Well, so today we're going to talk about light, right? How are you going to make money selling light? It comes out of the shiny thing in the sky, right? I mean, I know that these stupid photobiomodulation machines do exist and maybe there's some minor benefit of that. But for the most part, what we're talking about today is completely free, right? It's like quite hard to make money selling light. And the same is true of nutrition as well. Good luck, unless you want to do something like Impossible Burger.
Yeah,
and then there's the thing to make money, like, you know, some sort of pharmaceutical drug, say a PCSK9 inhibitor, right? Like maybe I can lower your ApoB to zero and claim that I can make some reduction in cardiovascular risks that way. And then maybe I have the government, like, or maybe I'm switching drugs now. Maybe I have the government do my marketing. Like, that's a fantastic business model. But I'm not sure there's like many examples of things that are both, that like are really, really helping people and a fantastic business. What do you think?
Yeah, and I also see the utility of some of those things that you just mentioned. But I think one
thing, and I'm not saying there's no utility. It's just I'm saying the things that are the most helpful are also the things that are hardest to make money doing.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think in some instances, people help people through those types of interventions, but there's a price tag attached to it. And because there's that sunk cost, all of a sudden people are that much more bought in and they're therefore more likely to experience the benefits from things that are free that they probably otherwise could have got without the handholding. But it's that financial investment that gets them across the line in the end.
And do you think the corporate app has solved that problem? Because I could imagine working for a big company and the HR department reaching out and saying, oh yeah, we've got this app and they're going to teach you about sleep, and me not being ready to hear that or not caring and rolling my eyes and deleting the email and moving on to the next damn thing that's due this afternoon. Do you think, is that a problem in the corporate wellness space?
Oh, of course. Of course. I think in the corporate wellness world, there are lots of issues. And one of them just relates to trying to understand the effectiveness of the interventions that you're delivering. That's very hard to do in the real world when there are so many different moving parts. I think another one is that, as you mentioned, people haven't necessarily actively opted into it themselves. And if they're not invested in the process, then they might not get that much from it. And for that reason, you have to make the content as engaging as possible. And the truth is, I don't know the best way to go about those things. In this particular instance, I wasn't involved in the way that the app goes about collecting data and so on. I'm just creating content for them. But I do think that there's the potential to really help people through that type of process. But I know we've spoken offline, Chris, about the fact that it could be that there always needs to be a human in the loop. You can try and automate things to the nth degree, but it might just be that you always need some sort of human coaching. Maybe with sufficient knowledge we'll get past that, but that could be the case.
All right, well, I apologize for the tangent. I do find these things interesting. Shall we get back to the topic at hand, which is the effect of light on human biology?
Sure.
Can you start by explaining the importance of this subject and its context in history?
Yeah. So if we think about this in terms of evolution, then life obviously evolved in the presence of predictable cycles of light and darkness. And to thrive in these types of changing environments, organisms evolved their own timekeeping mechanisms or biological clocks. And these produce biological rhythms. We've spoken about these previously, of course, but these are just predictable changes in biology and therefore behavior across different timescales. And we evolved from aquatic organisms. And a vestige of this is that we're most sensitive to blue light, because if you go underwater, then water filters out many other wavelengths, which explains why pretty much everything looks blue underwater.
Oh, I did not know that. Never really thought about that, but it makes total sense.
Are you a diver or a snorkeler, Chris?
Obviously, I've been underwater at some point in my life. Yeah, I've definitely done some snorkeling. I just never thought about why blue and not red or some other color, right?
Yeah, I was really frustrated a few years ago because I went on a diving holiday and I took my GoPro with me, but I didn't have an appropriate filter for the camera. And so I was seeing all of this incredible underwater life. And then when I looked back at the GoPro footage, it all looked rubbish. And since then, obviously, I've got an appropriate filter that does away with that washed out look that you get without an appropriate one. But anyway, just returning to what I was just saying, if you think about human history, then obviously for more than 90% of our time on the planet, there wasn't any electric light. All of our light came from sunlight during the day or firelight, moonlight and starlight at night. And then along came electric lighting. And I think a lot of people think that it was Edison who made the first electric light bulb. But it was actually a chemist named Humphrey Davy at the start of the 19th century. And then Edison filed a couple of patents which improved on the existing electric lights. And in 1880, he set up his electric light company and they started making the first commercially manufactured light bulbs at scale. And that was a really important step because it enabled people to work around the clock in shifts. And nowadays, of course, if you look at the world's population, most of us are exposed to light at night, perhaps 80% of us. And the area of the Earth that's exposed to light at night has grown, and also the intensity of the light has increased by just over 2% per year in recent years. And if you think about history, then there aren't really any natural analogues to this change in lighting at any point in history. And you've got to couple that with the fact that nowadays, a lot of us spend most of our time indoors. In industrialized societies, people might spend something like 90% of their time indoors on average. And if you look at the difference in the intensity of lighting indoors versus outdoors, then the difference is often enormous. In this room right now, the intensity of light might be something like 500 lux. And outdoors on a sunny day at midday, the intensity of the light might be more than 200 times that.
I've done that experiment with my Lux recorder, you know, Sachin Panda's app. It's definitely one worth doing if you ever get the opportunity.
I imagine that your light hygiene is probably quite good, Chris.
It is very good. Exactly. I've been learning about this stuff from you for a long time now, and I make sure I get outdoors first thing in the morning with the dogs and then avoid the light at night. And I think that's been really great for my sleep. And then also, perhaps more importantly, the sleep of my kids, you know, like my sleep is only as good as their sleep. And I think it's a huge mistake to leave all the lights on really bright at night and have them running around and then say, okay, it's time to go to bed now. Like, good luck. You're still 2 hours out, right? But we've spoken before about how light influences the circadian system. Can you briefly recap how this takes place?
Absolutely. When you think about light, there are so-called image-forming effects or visual effects. And if you look at the spectrum of light that we can see, then it ranges from about 400 to 700 nanometers. And in physics, light as a construct can refer to wavelengths that are outside this range too. So that includes things like gamma rays and X-rays and so on. But with that in mind, that there are a bunch of non-image forming effects of light too, and these include the circadian ones. And the circadian system, of course, is there to optimize our bodies for specific processes at certain times of day. And it helps us to anticipate and adapt to changes each day. And while it's likely that every cell in your body has its own molecular clock, a helpful way to think about your clock is by dividing it into a central or master clock in the brain. And then all of the clocks that exist outside of the master clock, and those are often collectively called peripheral clocks. And a common analogy that's used is that our clocks are a bit like an orchestra in which the central clock is the conductor and keeps time of the rest of the clocks. And this central clock is in the front of the hypothalamus, and it's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the SEN. And that's just because it sits above where the optic nerves cross. And the most important time cue for this clock is our patterns of light exposure, specifically at certain specialized cells at the back of the eye in the retina. And these are named intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells or melanopsin expressing cells, a bunch of different names that are used for them. But it's the stimulation of these cells specifically that can quickly shut down melatonin synthesis at night. It's the stimulation of these cells that can shift the timing of your body's clock and also exert some other non-visual effects. But these cells go back into the master clock through a neural tract. And they also reach out to some other brain regions that are involved in things like sleep-wake regulation and emotion control too. And the master clock then relays back to the pineal gland, which synthesizes melatonin. And then the melatonin acts on receptors in tissues throughout the body to tell those tissues that it's the biological nighttime, and therefore to engage in nighttime appropriate activities. The SEN does use some other ways of communicating time of day information, so things like neural projections. It produces some of its own secretions, and it also has some influence on your body temperature rhythm, which itself can help synchronize some clocks in some cells. But going back to light, when it comes to setting the time of this master clock, there are a few different aspects of light that are important. So one, of course, is the timing of your light exposure. And you can model this using a so-called phase response curve. Basically, that just means that when you're exposed to light, relative to the timing of your body's clock, will influence whether your body's clock accelerates, slows down, or doesn't change in its timing. Another key one is the duration of your light exposure. To be honest, we probably don't need that much time exposed to light each day to synchronize our body's clocks to the world around us. It might be something like 15 minutes, but just 15 minutes of light certainly won't be enough to maximally benefit from all these different non-visual effects. And then a key one, which we'll come back to a few times, I'm sure, is the spectrum of the light. And when it comes to light, the absorption of light depends on pigments in matter. So if you look at the rods in your eyes, which are involved in being able to see in dim light, then those contain a pigment named rhodopsin. And those are very sensitive and they absorb light of all wavelengths. You have cones in your eyes, which are important to color vision. They contain a few different opsins, and those absorb different wavelengths, so some red light, some green light, some blue light. And then those intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells that I mentioned earlier, they're concentrated in the lower part of the retina, which means that they respond to light in the upper half of the visual field. So obviously most strongly to overhead lighting, as comes from the sun. And they contain this pigment melanopsin. And that maximally absorbs photons from wavelengths of about 480 nanometers, which pretty much corresponds to blue light. And that matches the color of a clear blue sky at midday, of course. These cells can be affected by other wavelengths too, but it's certainly those short wavelengths that matter most. And because of the importance of these particular cells in those non-visual functions, scientists have tried to work out a way to assess the effect of light on those cells. And there was a consensus paper recently by Timothy Brown at Manchester and a bunch of experts in the subject. And they came up with some recommendations related to light hygiene. But the metric that they suggest using is the melanopic equivalent daytime illuminance, which is a bit of a mouthful.
That's amazing. That's off the tongue.
Yeah. So I'll just abbreviate that to melanopic EDI. But basically, since it's those melanopsin-containing cells that mediate most of the non-visual effects of light, it makes sense to have a measurement that accounts for that. And it's worth mentioning that that melanopic EDI isn't the same as so-called photopic EDI, which is what most people would refer to when they're talking about lux. And just as an example of this, if you look at electric lighting, which is very good at letting us discriminate different colors, so we can see very well in electric lighting, doesn't stimulate those melanopsin-containing cells at a given level of photopic illuminance as daylight does, because the composition of the different wavelengths in the light is quite different. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important to spend sufficient time in daylight each day. And so with all of that said, what should happen is that when you wake up in the morning, you will be exposed to some blue wavelength rich light that's going to trigger the production of certain chemicals in the brain, serotonin, dopamine, cortisol, which is going to help you get ready for the day. And then later in the day, as levels of blue light naturally drop and get replaced by red light and some longer wavelengths of light coming from different sources, but historically that might have been firelight, all of a sudden the brake on melatonin synthesis is taken off and you get a spike in melatonin production, and that organizes your body's clockwork to get you ready for a period of resting and fasting.
And that's interesting you use the word spike. That's certainly been my personal experience, is if you miss that spike at the beginning of the evening and go to bed 2 hours late, then it's often surprisingly hard to get to sleep. Would that spike be why?
Possibly. typically, I think what you'd see is just that dim light melatonin onset's cooled, would just occur slightly later if you've been doing something that involves exposure to lots of short wavelength light, whether that's using your phone or watching TV or just having the overhead lights on. And it could instead be some other brain mechanisms that are contributing to that cognitive arousal that you feel. So if you look at smartphones, for example, a lot of the focus historically has been on the light that they produce. However, I think it's actually the stimulatory content and the loss of the sense of time passing that contributes to a lot of the cognitive arousal and sleep delaying effects of using those devices.
And can you walk us through a typical day for you? I'm sorry to push you on these practical things, but I do think it's important, especially because I know that you've been traveling quite a lot over the last couple of years. And that suggests to me that you don't always have complete control over your environment, especially the lighting environment. Right? It's like, not like you can start installing fancy computer-controlled bulbs that emit different wavelengths of light at different times of day or anything like that, right?
Yeah, of course. And we'll come back to some recommendations later, I'm sure, but I'll just touch on a few things that I do. And this is all very self-indulgent, and I'm not recommending this, but this is just how I deal with that particular situation. So I think one of them is just keeping the bedroom as dark as possible. And that might include putting up some blackout blinds or just some sort of portable way of blocking light coming in from outdoors, because different bedrooms can be very different in that respect. I'm a bit of a Nazi about the different devices that we have in the bedroom. And we have an alarm clock, but that emits red light because red light is much less disruptive to the circadian system than other lights. So if you have an alarm clock that you have to use, then you definitely want to choose one that emits red light. But we don't take smartphones or anything like that into the bedroom, don't have a laptop, don't have a TV or anything like that. And if we do, then I don't use it. We've never had a TV in a bedroom where we've just sat there and watched it late at night or anything like that. And then when I need to use the toilet at night, I won't turn on any lights unless it's absolutely essential. And I think you quickly get used to doing that. However, if I was speaking to an old person about this, then it's really important, of course, that you minimize the likelihood of them falling over, because if they trip and fracture a hip, then all of a sudden they can be in a very bad place. So I think it's important to have a clear pathway to the bathroom. But assuming that's the case, I think keep the lights as low as possible or keep them off entirely. And then during the daytime, if the sun isn't up yet, but I'm awake, then I'll tend to try and keep the lights down as low as possible. And in particular, I tend to try and avoid overhead lighting because of the position of those specialized cells that I mentioned earlier.
That is incredible. I'd never heard that before, but the position matters too. That's amazing.
Again, if you just think about evolution, Chris, and the fact that people would have been sat around.
I know, but it's just amazing that it's like that specific, you know?
Yeah. So I tend to keep a lamp with me. It's a lamp that has a bulb that emits quite a warm white light, not particularly strong, but enough to see, enough to be able to read and so on. And if we were in somewhere that didn't have dimmers and it had strong overhead lighting, then I definitely look to use that if possible. If that wasn't the case, then I would use blue blocking glasses, but that hasn't been the case yet. And unfortunately, I'm blind as a bat and I don't have a pair of blue blocking glasses with my prescription. So they wouldn't be practical for me right now. But then otherwise, fortunately, being self-employed, my schedule is quite flexible and I spend lots of time outdoors each day on my feet in daylight, probably something like 2.5-3 hours during the week and more than that on the weekends, which is certainly a very privileged position. But all of that outdoor daylight exposure during the day is going to strongly buffer against any small effects of light at night coming from devices. And I think that's a piece of the story that's often missed in discussions of this particular subject.
It's funny you say that that's a privileged position. I'm thinking about my friend. I spent the day with him yesterday. He spent the last 53 years living in a teepee and he does construction work and spends almost zero time indoors, right? And you know, there's not many windows in the teepee, but he just doesn't spend much time in there either. So I'm just trying to think, is he privileged? I'm not really sure. In some ways, yes. Okay, well, we'll get back to some more practical stuff later, but can you tell us about some of the other ways that daylight affects us?
Yeah, I actually alluded to one then, which is the quality of your vision. So if you look at short-sightedness, then it's very clear that insufficient daylight during the day contributes to the growing prevalence of myopia in young people. And this is particularly stark in parts of Asia. Typically, it starts when kids are around four or so. And unfortunately, if you wear glasses, then you're not going to stop the progression. You might end up getting to the point where, like me, your vision is minus 5.5 in both eyes. And you can basically... Yeah, you can see something which is about 2 inches from your eyes, but no further than that. But anyway, we don't understand that much about what leads to the type of eye growth that produces that short-sightedness. But some of it probably relates to dopamine signaling within the retina. And importantly, that's influenced by light exposure. It's not just doing lots of close work.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's what I've been led to believe. I did an interview with Todd Becker in 2014. Can you believe that? How long ago it was? Well, he talked about that myopia was a normal consequence of doing too much close-up work, which is, of course, what everyone does now when they're working on a computer or their phone, right? And he that myopia was somewhat reversible through techniques like print pushing, but there's probably limits, and maybe 5.5 diopters is beyond that limit.
Yeah, maybe. And of course, the two things do tend to go hand in hand to some degree. And I'm sure that doing close work does contribute a bit, but I suspect that spending too much time indoors contributes relatively more to that. And there's some interesting research on rodents showing that it could be light exposure specifically that is at play here. And it might also be that light exposure is particularly important at certain times of day. So there have been some studies in which people change the expression of certain genes and then provide animals with light at different times of day. And basically, it seems that some of those opsin-expressing cells determine whether the animals end up short-sighted, but that's in combination with light at certain times of day. And when the nocturnal rodents are given light in the evening, which is their biological morning, then that protects them against the development of short-sightedness. And so based on that, you might assume that light in the morning, the biological morning, is particularly important for these young people if they want to maintain their vision as they get older. And I'm not saying that I would necessarily expect that to be the case, but certainly there are lots of shared mechanisms between rodents and ourselves. So it wouldn't surprise me if that is true. And I think as a rule of thumb, if you can get outdoors for at least a couple of hours each day and ideally probably reduce the amount of close work that you do, then that's going to help you avoid progression in that direction over time. And obviously, it's important also to break up some of that close work, even if that's just staring out the window and letting your mind wander, which is probably good for you in other ways too. But just moving on to some other ways by which not getting enough daylight affects us. One of them, of course, is related to vitamin D synthesis. So I know that you've done a podcast with Megan about the subject, so I won't retrace those steps too much here, but that's synthesized in response to UVB radiation from daylight, and vitamin D is important for all sorts of different body processes, bone health, immune function, and so on. There's been a lot of research recently looking at the effects of light exposure on mood and cognition. And if you've experienced seasonal affective disorder, then you'll know just how strong these effects can be. But if we return to those specialized cells, the intrinsically photosensitive ones, then those project to parts of the brain that are involved in motion regulation. And while light exposure probably affects mood in part through the circadian system, it probably also does so through some non-circadian mechanisms too. And there's a pathway from these cells to the perihabenular nucleus, which is part of the epithalamus. And the thalamus and the hypothalamus and the subthalamus are also part of the structure. But the nucleus is very close to lots of neurons that influence mood and stress. And based on preclinical studies, that seems to be particularly important, the effects of light on mood. And then with respect to cognition, there's probably more research on humans than there is on mood. And just to give you one example of this, there was recently some work done by Leila Grant from Brigham and Women's Hospital that looked at the effects of different light exposure patterns on cognitive performance in students. And they divided them into four different groups. And the four groups had the same photopic illuminance. So the light would look quite similar to you and I, but different melanopic illuminants. And they basically found that in the people who had the highest melanopic illuminants, so mimicking daylight, they had better performance on an addition task. They completed a motor learning task faster, and they were less sleepy too. And that effect on alertness is very consistent across different studies. And there also seem to be some effects of light on other aspects of our biology, one of which is cardiometabolic health. And Chris, you probably tuned into a podcast that Dan Pardy did with Peter Light a few years ago, but that sparked my interest in the subject first. And he did some work showing that our fat cells express the gene that encodes melanopsin. And if you take them out of us and you put them in a dish with appropriate media and you expose them to blue light, then you can stimulate lipolysis in them, which suggested that it could be that these cells are sensitive to light and that light can thereby influence substrate metabolism. And very recently, there's been some research by some scientists in the Netherlands, and they took overweight, insulin-resistant people, put them in a metabolic chamber, and took them through a couple of different conditions. So in one of these, they had a very bright daytime, and I think the daytime was between about 8 a.m. and 6 p.m., and then a dim evening up until 11 p.m., which mimics the type of pattern of light exposure that we would generally recommend. And then in the other condition, they had dim light during the day and then bright light at night. And they found that spending the day in bright light, so the recommended condition, resulted in a small increase in triglyceride levels after breakfast and then lower glucose levels before dinner. And then spending the evening in bright light, so inverting that pattern, actually reduced the increase in blood sugar after dinner, which you might expect because, as we've spoken about previously, Chris, one of the effects of melatonin is to reduce glucose-stimulated insulin secretion. So if you give somebody melatonin and then you give them a bolus of carbohydrates shortly afterwards, then if that's during the day, then their blood sugar responses are going to be much greater than if they didn't have that melatonin. And of course, they also found that the melatonin production in the evening was strongly suppressed by that evening bright light. And interestingly, they found that metabolic rate during sleep was lower after the dim daytime and the bright evening than it was during the recommended light pattern. So just putting a few things together there, it seems likely that bright light around the time of meals is going to influence your blood sugar control, probably favorably. But even if that's true at dinner time, if you look at the combination of different things that they found, then you would probably expect some negative consequences over time if you continually expose yourself to lots of bright light late in the day. And then the final thing that I'll touch on is, of course, just your skin itself. And we all understand on some level that light affects our skin, and our melanocytes in the skin will absorb UV light, and that can result in tanning. And exposing your skin to UV radiation from the sun will also suppress some types of immune activity. And for that reason, people are interested in using it to treat inflammatory skin conditions. But of course, it's a double-edged sword because in excess, ultraviolet radiation has the potential to be carcinogenic. And I'm not a dermatologist and don't know a great deal about that, so we won't spend too much time discussing it today. But overall, that's a long way of saying that light affects many different aspects of our biology, and often in positive ways. At the same time, it's important to build our tolerance to adapt to it and to avoid any stark changes in our light environment that could result in, say, burning, which over time is going to increase our risk of skin cancer.
You know, and Tommy wrote Highlights 15 way back in the day, and I still go back to that document on a regular basis. It's a fantastic piece of work where he argues that sun avoidance is terrible health advice, and really avoiding the sun is way more dangerous than any potential danger from burning. And he's not arguing that you should get a sunburn, right? You think what most people do in the UK, certainly what I did in the UK when I was working as a computer programmer in London, is I would spend 99.9% of my time indoors. And then for 2 weeks of the year, I go on holiday to Spain and get completely frazzled, like on day one. You know? And then I go back to repeating the inside cycle.
Like a true Brit.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, that's the worst possible thing that you can do. Contrast to what I do now as a computer programmer living in Northern California, which is I start getting outside naked in January and I slowly build a base tan. Now it's the end of April and I've got a really solid tan and I can essentially stay outdoors here for hours on end and not need any kind of sunscreen whatsoever. And I don't get burned. And yesterday the UV index was 10 and I can make 7,000 IU of vitamin D in 30 minutes. So the sun is really quite strong here. And the same has been true for my kids. They go to outdoor forest school and they have never had sunscreen applied to them and they've never had a sunburn. But it's that slow incremental buildup that goes with the season. Rather than the step function changes seem to be problematic, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And isn't it amazing when modern research confirms ancient wisdom? You know, I think your grandmother would have been able to tell you that getting outdoors in the sunshine feels fantastic, right? Like even my cat knows that. It knows to sunbathe on the deck in the sunniest spot, you know? Yet somehow we find it necessary to do experiments to confirm this, which is great too. I love the technical details.
Yeah, I think there have been various publications that align with what Tommy wrote in those highlights. I don't think I've read those specific highlights, but I'm sure that they're in the same direction. And I think one thing that I'll add is that it's interesting speaking to people from different specialties about the subject, because if you speak to a circadian biologist, then they will generally be very pro-light, at least during the day. Get more sunlight, you'll experience more of those beneficial non-visual effects, etc. If you speak to an ophthalmologist, then you might get quite a different answer. They might start speaking to you about the fact that excessive light exposure to the eye is going to influence your risk of macular degeneration, cataracts, and so on. And then if you speak to a dermatologist, then you'll probably hear a lot about skin cancer. And so one of the things I always try and do is understand something about those different perspectives, just so that I'm not too blinkered, because given that most of my interest in this has come through the lens of circadian biology, I recognize how prone to bias I can be.
Well, that's a fantastic oversight. Thank you. You already told us a little bit about how artificial light at night affects us. Is there anything else you'd want to say about that?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. It's a big subject in itself. And one of the reasons for this, of course, is the fact that proportion of the planet that's exposed to the light at night is increasing over time. And there are also certain forms of light exposure at night that are quite hard to study. So one of these is sky glow. Are you familiar with sky glow, Chris?
No, I've never heard that word before.
So sky glow is basically the light that gets scattered back to Earth as a result of aerosols and clouds. And so when you have lots of anthropogenic light, you end up having a lot of it coming back down to you. And as a result, light is more pervasive than it would be otherwise. So if you look at areas outside of cities, for instance, then it could be that some urban light pollution is sprawling into those regions as a result of sky glow. And it can be so faint that we can't really see it. But some researchers think that it could still threaten something like 30% of vertebrates and 60% of invertebrates that are nocturnal, because they're so sensitive to light. And now some scientists are developing ways of trying to study sky glow more effectively. There's a center in Germany, for instance, that has worked on ways to mimic it in a research setting. So I think we'll find out much more about it in years to come. But just returning to the type of artificial light at night that most of us typically think about, then if you look at cross-sectional data, then one of the subjects that's often spoken about is the fact that light seems to be a plausible contributor to the development of breast cancer. I think the epidemiology is a bit inconclusive, but there are some mechanisms that might make sense. So the melatonin suppression that you get from light at night and some other endocrine system disruption could contribute. Melatonin obviously has some roles in immune system regulation too, and it also will affect sleep, and some of those changes could contribute to the propagation of cancer. But then beyond cancer, there's cross-sectional research looking at things like obesity. To be honest, I don't read too much into those data. There's some interesting work looking at light exposure in elderly people and the fact that it seems to associate with increased risk of depression. But the controlled studies, I think, can tell us a bit more about what's going on. And so one of the things that, of course, is very relevant is the fact that light around the time at which you go to bed can influence the timing of your sleep. And if you get lots of high intensity light that's rich in those short wavelengths between about 2 hours before you go to bed and 2 hours after you would typically fall asleep, then you're going to shift your body's clock later. And if you have to wake at a certain time in the morning, that's going to compress your sleep period, reducing the amount of sleep that you can get. But beyond the effects of light on circadian timing, it also seems that light might affect sleep homeostasis a bit. And Christian Kyokin, who is in Switzerland, has done some great work on this, basically showing that if you expose people to blue-rich light in the evening, then you get less slow-wave activity in frontal brain regions. And that seems to be particularly the case during the start of the sleep period. So sleep later in the night might not look too different, but less slow-wave sleep over time could contribute to some brain abnormalities. That seems plausible. And then there also seems to be some effects on the sympathetic nervous system. And some of this work has looked at cortisol. Claude Granvier from Lyon has done some nice work on this, basically showing that if you take healthy people and you give them either intermittent bright light, continuous bright light, or dim light during the biological nighttime when they normally be asleep, then light linearly increases cortisol levels, and it does so quite quickly. And obviously that happens in lockstep with a reduction in melatonin production too. And over time, that could contribute to all sorts of brain and body abnormalities. And then very recently, Phyllis C, who's done some terrific research on the subject of how light affects us, published a study in PNAS in which she took healthy adults and had them sleep in a lab, exposing them to what I think is in this context a relatively large amount of light. So it was 100 lux during the sleep period. And perhaps unsurprisingly, these people had higher nighttime heart rate. They had lower heart rate variability. They were more insulin resistant the next morning. And there seemed to be some relationship between the balance in the nervous system and insulin levels. So it could be that that sympathetic activity is having some downstream metabolic regulation effects too. So I think there are lots of reasons that we should look to limit our exposure to light at night. And we should also be thinking about both our daytime light exposure and our nighttime light exposure.
What about moonlight? I can't resist asking that. And maybe it's more of a personal problem. But you know, here where we are in Bonnie Doon, there isn't much light pollution. There's no street lights here. And we're far enough away from most civilization for there to not be much of sky glow, I think. And we also, it's never rarely overcast at night too, might make a difference. But quite obviously, frequently, once a month, there is very bright moonlight. Mm-hmm. And it's really bright. Like I can move around our garden, walk up and down trails and stuff without having any artificial light at all. And I sleep outdoors in the Eurovan still. The pop top, you know, and it's got these zip down sides and it's this mosquito net between me and the outdoors, which I love. It's fantastic for breathing. And I love listening to all the outdoor nighttime sounds are like very good for me to get to sleep and stay asleep. But yeah, some nights it's like super bright and I don't do anything about that, assuming that, you know, nature has had a long time to work on this and there's something about moonlight that's somehow different. But maybe I'm wrong about that. What do you think?
I think it definitely does affect sleep. And there was some research by Horacio de la Iglesia, who's at the University of Washington, where Tommy is, on the subject last year, which is really interesting. And they looked at whether the phase of the moon affects sleep, both in people with electricity and in people without it. So the people without it was a community in Argentina, and the people with it was just undergrad students at the University of Washington. And they found that people fell asleep later and got less sleep on the nights before full moon. And that probably isn't too surprising based on what you just said, Chris, but the changes in sleep onset were quite big. So if you look within a person, then the changes in sleep onset varied from about 30 minutes to about 80 minutes over the course of the lunar cycle. And as a result of that, the changes in sleep duration varied by a similar amount. One interesting nuance that they found was that there actually seemed to be two cycles within that roughly 30-day lunar cycle. Because, and this is very speculative, and I don't really know what's going on here, let's be honest, but the moon's gravitational pull is very high twice during each lunar month, so roughly every 15 days or so. And if you look at the data, then there seem to be basically two cycles within each 29 and a half day lunar cycle. So there seems to be something going on related to gravitational pull too. But what that is, I frankly have no idea at all.
Super interesting. I wonder why that be then, if like the biology is so exquisitely involved, the light-dark cycle, the difference between overhead and eye line would make a difference, yet the moon should cause a problem, but the physiology has not adapted to that. Is it like the combination of people spending 90% of the time indoors, having artificial light at night, then suddenly the moon can become a problem? I'm not sure.
Well, I think because they saw it in the pre-industrial people too, that's just something that's likely been there throughout human history. But because in the course of human history, we probably haven't artificially truncated our sleep the way that many of us do nowadays, those night-to-night variations in sleep duration probably weren't too much of a problem. Whereas nowadays, they're superimposed on a background of insufficient sleep or poor quality sleep or sleep disorders. And so maybe the consequences of that variability are different compared to people who are relatively well-rested and who live in less light-polluted areas. Don't know. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there's a great deal of individual variability to how people respond to light at night?
Yeah, there seems to be. One way that you can look at this is just how much light at night suppresses melatonin synthesis. And children seem to be most photosensitive in this way, and elderly seem to be the least photosensitive. In the case of relatively elderly people, there are probably a few different things that contribute to this. So one is just that the lens of the eye itself gets cloudy. Another is that the pupil size seems to decrease a bit over time, but also pupillary responses to change in light are more sluggish in elderly people. And so as a result of that, at a given melanopic EDI, which is that word salad that I mentioned earlier, it seems that melatonin suppression is maybe about half what you see in young people, in elderly people, in response to a given light stimulus. And interestingly, if you take elderly people who have cataracts and you put them through cataract surgery and you replace their intraocular lenses, then their responses to light all of a sudden look much more like the responses of young people. So I think the lens really is important in that context. But there are definitely differences between people of a given age too. And Sean Kane has done some great work on this recently. So just as an example of this, he had people in a lab and exposed them to quite a wide range of different light intensities. I think it was 10 to 2000 lux, and looked at how much that suppressed melatonin. And he was looking specifically at young, healthy people. And he found that first, melatonin was suppressed at relatively low light levels. But if you look from one person to the next, there was a massive difference in how light sensitive people were. And specifically, they found a roughly 50-fold difference between the least Wow. and most light sensitive people. And so while some people reduce their melatonin synthesis by about 50% in response to just 10 lux of light, which is not much light at all, one person required, I think, about 400 lux to get that same response. So clearly there are quite big differences just between people of a given age. And I think some of those probably relate to pupil size. There's some interesting work looking at that. And in general, it seems that the degree to which melatonin synthesis is suppressed is quite strongly correlated to pupil area during light exposure. So it's just that some of us have larger pupils than others. Some of us have stronger pupillary responses to light too.
Do you think that humans are seasonal? You know, over the years, I've heard various people suggest that perhaps our diet should be somewhat seasonal. You know, if carbohydrates were more available in the summer, say, then perhaps you should eat them. And when they perhaps weren't available in the winter, then maybe more of a high-fat ketogenic approach might be better. But do you think there is any evidence that humans are indeed seasonal?
So I think in the context of nutrition, it makes sense to eat with the seasons regardless, even just in terms of local food quality and food waste and so on. But
if
we put that to the side, then there's definitely evidence that the human circadian system will adapt to the seasons. Chris, I think we've probably spoken a couple of times about the camping experiments that Ken Wright did.
Oh yeah, they come up on the podcast every. I mean, it's just the most beautiful. It's just like, so it's like a great story as well as a scientific reference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a cool experiment. But basically, if you compare the data they collected of people camping in the Rockies during the summer to people camping in the Rockies during the winter, then I think the difference in the duration of overnight melatonin synthesis was roughly 4 hours between the two different conditions. So clearly our body's clocks track the photo period. Mm. But with that said, it's very hard to study seasonal changes in humans. There seems to be some overlap with changes in other animals. So if you look at thyroid hormones, for example, there was a meta-analysis published last year, and they found that in women, circulating thyroid stimulating hormones are a bit higher in the winter than they are in other seasons. They found a bunch of other seasonal changes too that I won't go into specifically, but while the magnitude of those changes is small, it might be worth bearing in mind when it comes to things like getting blood tests. And I'm curious as to whether you see that in any of your data, Chris, at MBT, and whether you think about seasonal variation and things like blood tests.
I have not thought to go looking for that.
Fair enough. I don't think most people do. But I think part of the reason for that is that the size of the effects are probably relatively small. And the other hormone that it might affect is testosterone, and possibly some other sex hormones too. And it seems likely to me that testosterone or sex hormones and thyroid hormones are the hormones that are going to be most affected by these seasonal fluctuations. But there have been a few cross-sectional studies showing that men's testosterone levels are higher in the summer than they are in the winter. Mm. And testosterone levels seem to positively correlate with how long the photo period is and also with ambient temperature. One tricky thing here, of course, is disentangling the effects of the photo period of light per se from the fact that longer photo periods tend to relate to higher temperatures too. And it could be that temperature plays some small role. But there's also some evidence that LH levels, so luteinizing hormone, might have a couple of different peaks within the year. And there's some work that's been quite widely discussed recently suggesting that daylight exposure can increase testosterone and maybe estrogen a little bit too, as well as libido, interest in sex. And it could be that the reason for this is that ultraviolet B radiation activates P53 in some skin cells. And I think we need more work on that subject. I'm sure that there's some melatonin signaling that's at play too. But that seasonal variation in testosterone does seem to be found quite consistently. So I think there is something to that. And then obviously there are probably those seasonal changes in mood that we've touched on earlier. So seasonal affective disorder, basically depressive symptoms that happen at a specific time of year, typically in the autumn or winter, and that go into remission at other times of year. Mm. And that's more common in people who live at high latitudes. So I think those are probably the main ones. But as I mentioned, Chris, I think nowadays in our post-industrial world, there are so many things that we do that aren't in keeping with how the world would have been previously, that probably obfuscate any effects of the seasons on our biology. And we also superimpose certain things on those seasonal changes each year too. So if you think about, say, the holidays, then there's seasonal variation in body weight because a lot of people overindulge during the Thanksgiving and Christmas period. And so that's probably largely culturally driven rather than it is driven by, say, change in the photo period. And for that reason, it can be much easier to study photoperiodism or phenological changes in other animals, so bears and sheep and so on, than it is in humans.
Mm-hmm. I mean, could it be that we're still adapting to living far from the equator, right? Like there's far less seasonal variation when you're on the equator, maybe just a wet and a dry season, but not really the changes in the photo period like you see when you're living in the UK, say. And I mean, obviously there's some adaptation because that's what white skin is for, right? That's an adaptation mm-hmm. from living far from the equator. So could it be that we're still struggling to adapt from that? And then like anyone, I've spent some time in the northern parts of Finland in the winter and oh my God, it's just like unlivable in the same way as you might think living in outer space might be too much of a mismatch for the human physiology to adapt, you know? So could it just be that we should all still be living on the equator?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there are some small adaptations present in some people. So if you look at certain circadian relevant genes, then you seem to see some variation according to somebody's ancestry and where they live. And I think Tommy and I probably spoke about that briefly on a podcast that we recorded about chronotype a few years ago.
I've listened to that one at least twice as well.
But beyond that and beyond some other changes that you see in things like genes that encode proteins that are involved in the desaturation of certain fatty acids, there's not a huge amount of evidence showing stark adaptations to latitude specifically, and some of the things that come with latitude, whether that's changes in the availability of plant foods versus animal foods and so on. So I'm sure that we are still adapting, but truth be told, I'm also sure that evolution won't be able to keep pace with the rate at which technology is overhauling our lives too.
Right. Yeah, culture and technology change super fast, whereas the biology very much slower.
That's it.
So when you said that spending time outdoors is a privilege, I wasn't quite sure about that, but having access to you on WhatsApp definitely is. And the question that sparked this entire conversation was about daylight savings time. So can you tell us about daylight saving time and whether or not you think it's a good idea?
Yeah, I think it's an awful idea.
Okay, that's easy. Next question.
And here's why. So daylight savings time each year, the clocks spring forward. It's an easy way to remember it. They spring forward. And it just advances the social clock. But that doesn't mean that our biological clocks move in time with that change in the social clock. And the result is a series of problems. One of these has been demonstrated a few times, but my favorite demonstration of it was by Celine Vetter a couple of years ago. And they looked at the effects of the spring daylight saving time transition on traffic accidents in the US, and they found that it associated with a 6% rise in fatal traffic accidents. And lots of those took place in the morning. And interestingly, people in the west of the time zone seem to be affected more than people in the east, because if you think about the fact that our body's clocks still somewhat follow sun time, then people in the west of the time zone are going to fall asleep later than people in the east. But they're all waking up at the same social time. So they end up getting less sleep. And therefore, they're going to be more affected by something like daylight savings time than people in the east. So all else being equal, you probably want to live in the east of a time zone. Another interesting effect of daylight savings time is that it might trigger a small spike in cardiovascular events, mm-hmm. heart attacks and so on. The size of that is not large at all, but it's been consistently documented. And if you just think about the diurnal variation in these events, then they tend to cluster in the morning for all sorts of reasons. So it's no great surprise that waking up somebody who's already disposed to those events early in the day under duress is potentially going to trigger some problems for that person. One of the interesting consequences of daylight savings time is also some effects on your workplace performance. Christopher Barnes, who is also at the University of Washington, I believe, has done some interesting work on this, finding that daylight savings time increases cyberloafing, which is basically just wasting time on the internet when you should be doing some real work. And so the moral of the story is that we should have standard time year round. And there is perfect agreement among circadian biologists about this. And as much as they try to shift perspectives of people within governments, their perspectives haven't quite landed yet. And so I'm just crossing my fingers that that does change over time. Then if we just think briefly about time zones in general too, then given that our clocks do follow the sun, and Till Ronenberg and Martha Mara have done some nice work showing that they do, showing specifically that people in the west of Germany sleep later than people in the east of Germany, then if you look at some parts of the world, there are massive discrepancies between the enforced social times and the actual environmental time based on the sun clock. And a couple of examples of these are Galicia in northwestern Spain. It's about 1.5 hours out of sync with the sun. And then China uses a single time zone, despite the fact that it's massive. And so the actual difference in the sun time between different parts of China can be more than 4 hours. And yet they all follow Beijing time, which is just asinine.
Yeah, it's super interesting. You know, just the idea of time is a mismatch, right? Like, it's an invention to synchronize workers in an industrial setting, surely. Mm-hmm. Like, what other purpose does it serve? I know this from talking, interviewing anthropologists that, you know, hunter-gatherers do not keep the time, right? Like, they don't keep calendar time either. I mean, they know about events. I'll never forget that episode of, Bruce Parry. And he talked about it's like an indigenous people that, like, moving on. And he said, well, when will you move on? And they said, when the birds fly, we go. And Bruce said, when will that be? And they said, well, when the birds fly, then we go. Like, they literally have no concept of time in the same way that we do.
Yeah, and it's, I'm sure you've experienced this, Chris. You go to some parts of the world, typically islands, and whenever somebody turns up late, they're always like, oh, Fiji time. Yeah, so it's always the same way. There's always a German bloke sat in the corner getting furious. He's desperately trying to control his anger at the fact that things don't run on time.
When you talked about the difference in cardiovascular deaths, do you know if there was any difference between the clocks going forward in the spring and falling back in the fall?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the fall, there doesn't seem to be an obvious reversal of the negative things I just described.
Okay.
So while you'd expect people to get a bit more sleep, that there's not the inverse of the consequences that I mentioned.
But there is a difference. So it's not just the change per se that messes people up.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if there have been statistically significant differences, but I say statistically significant because you have to bear in mind power and so on. Mm. And so it strikes me that there's likely an effect, but maybe the size of that effect is too small to have been detected so far. And obviously, what you see is all there is. If you go looking for something, then there either is an effect or there isn't effect. But because you're not looking more globally at lots of different things, you're surely missing certain things that are taking place that maybe we find out about in 10 years' time.
Mm-hmm. So what do you make of the bill in the US to make daylight savings time permanent? It seems to me like they're doing the exact wrong thing, but then I'm not sure I should be terribly surprised at that, because that seems to be the MO in public health, right? This discussion on the forum recently, like, of the kind of merger of right-wing conspiracy theory and kind of this utopian wellness scene, and maybe you could, like, include me in that scene, but certainly not the right-wing conspiracy. And, you know, my observation was, well, first of all, everybody loves conspiracy theories. Like, even super smart people love to spend time on Wikipedia trying to figure out whether the FBI really did kill Martin Luther King. It was a fun afternoon. But secondly, like, there's a long history of getting the public health advice exactly wrong. Like, I still can't believe the nutritional guidelines are that far wrong. And then another one we already mentioned, that perhaps sun avoidance is possibly the worst health advice ever. And here we are again. Oh, let's just make the wrong thing permanent. Am I right? Did I get it wrong? Like, it's just like, is it true that they really are going to make daylight savings time permanent? And is it the exact wrong thing to do?
It is the exact wrong thing to do. Yeah, they should make standard time permanent. I wish that we could look at the counterfactual in a different parallel universe. Mm. And we could compare daylight savings time to permanent standard time to permanent daylight savings time. And when I said daylight savings time the first time, I meant to include the transition each year. Obviously, we can't do that. One minor advantage of having the same time year round is that you might potentially improve sleep regularity, but the size of that effect would likely be small because there aren't many transitions during the year. And of course, the trade-off is that you're compressing the sleep period for everybody living within that time zone, or almost everybody. I suppose the silver lining might be that many of us have more control over our schedules now than we used to, living in the COVID-19 era. And so perhaps the consequences of permanent daylight savings time will be smaller than they would have been had it been enforced 50 years ago. Again, there's no way of knowing that, but I think that's a reasonable hypothesis.
It's certainly reasonable in my life. I now have tremendous flexibility that I didn't have before. You know, when I started my apprenticeship in electronic engineering, I can remember I used to have to punch in. I had one of those machines on the wall with a piece of paper. Printed the time you arrived at work on a piece of paper. And I got a £15 bonus if I got in on time for the whole week. That's not true anymore. And we've got people all over the world. Like, the time zone differences are extraordinary, you know, and asynchronous messaging has become quite important for that reason. So maybe all is not lost.
Yeah, I'm happy with the way that things are now.
Exactly. So up until now, we focused on humans, but what about the effects of changes in light environment on other species, starting with non-human animals?
So some of the effects are quite big. Obviously, you've got animals that are very seasonal. I mentioned bears earlier, they hibernate. You look at ewes and they're particularly reproductively active only at certain times of year. So I think that's the mid-autumn. But there are probably more pervasive effects of the light-dark cycle on animals than a lot of people have previously recognized. And there's a guy at Exeter University, Kevin Gaston, who published a widely discussed meta-analysis on the subject last year. And it was a huge meta-analysis. They included lots and lots of data from many different studies. And they only included studies in which animals were exposed to intensities of light between 1 and 100 lux at night. And interestingly, their meta-regression, which tried to disentangle the relative importance of the intensity of light, suggested that intensity wasn't actually that important. But most of these studies, they were done in the USA, in Europe and Australia, and they found that light at night changes physiology and behavior of organisms in many ways. It affects hormone levels, so melatonin suppression is an obvious one. It seems to affect patterns of activity too. So in general, animals become active earlier in the day when they're exposed to artificial light at night. And that's especially true of diurnal species. And in diurnal species, they're active over longer periods each day, which probably makes sense to you, Chris, just given how most people don't spend enough time in bed or get enough sleep nowadays. But the light at night might also affect things like feeding. And obviously, some animals use the light in certain ways. They move towards it in a process known as phototaxis. And just to give a couple of examples of specific animals, maybe the most widely discussed and one that evokes very strong emotions among some people is seafinding by young turtles. And that's just the ability to find the right direction towards the sea. And basically, if they're exposed to artificial light, then they're more likely to end up moving towards the landward light source, as you might well have seen during a David Attenborough documentary or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then it could be that light at night affects nocturnal species more than diurnal ones, because those species are basically losing the conditions, so darkness, under which they're most active. And that's probably more limiting than extending the dark period. And if you look at Gaston's analysis, then some measures of activity and life history, and life history measures are basically anything that affects the survival of a species. The effect sizes for nocturnal animals were more negative than they were for diurnal ones. And then some other examples are insects. Obviously, those are really important food sources for many animals, and they're also pollinators in many ecosystems. And it's thought that artificial light at night is wiping out many different insects and species of insects too at a startling rate. Some of them just fly straight into lamps and sizzle. Some of them get knackered after circling lamps for hours on end. And one interesting subject, just turning away from insects, is that even within a given animal, some species seem to fare better than others. And this is certainly true of bats. So some types of bats will feast on the insects that are circling around the lamps, whereas others, which are more light shy, have lost their habitats and they've just disappeared from some places and they're on the verge of extinction now. And then I'll also just add that the effects can, of course, ripple through multiple different ecosystems. So it might be, for instance, that if there are street lamps that are near some sort of water-filled aquatic environment, then the insects will migrate from the water environment to the lamps. And that's then depriving predators within the aquatic ecosystem of their food. And so that ecosystem is less likely to thrive over time. And related to that, some of these changes in those ecosystems, of course, are going to affect human health too, because artificial light is going to affect ecosystem services. So the benefits that those ecosystems provide to us. And as an example of that, if plants aren't being pollinated at the same rate because of change in patterns of activity of certain insects, then the plants are going to produce less fruit. And that's going to mean less food for humans too. So while some people listening might think, why are you talking about insects and plants? It's going to affect us too. I think that's really important to recognize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're reminding me that the moment you think of humans as somehow separate and above nature, you get into trouble and the worst acts of atrocity become possible, right?
Mm.
But what do you do, Greg? Have you got any solutions for us?
With respect to ecosystems and...
Yeah, exactly. How do you minimize the impact on the ecosystem by artificial light at night?
Yeah, well, I think obviously it's pretty hard. But with that said, there are various things that you can do with respect to things like lighting outdoors. And I think keeping the light levels at the lowest level possible should be the standard. And you can also do things like control the street lights. They can be dimmed when they're not in use. And yep, this has been rolled out in some countries. So I think there's a part of the Netherlands where they lower their street lights by something like 80% when there's no activity. And then they sense when there is activity and they turn up accordingly. Obviously, that's great in terms of energy economy, but it's also probably good for many of the animals in surrounding ecosystems. And that type of intelligent lighting is expensive, but the investments probably pay back quite quickly. And I know that was certainly true in the case of the Netherlands. And maybe we should think in particular about rolling out some of this type of technology within certain regions. So perhaps it's relatively more important in certain places to support biodiversity. And then we also, of course, need to think about the spectrum of light that's emitted. If you look at bats, for instance, then returning to the Netherlands, there's some work showing that red light didn't affect any of the bat species that they looked at. And that suggests that maybe we could use red light instead of full spectrum light in a way that still lets us see, but is minimally disruptive to many of these species. And obviously our different biological clocks are wired differently. However, if you think about the different light sources that they respond to, they all respond to some of the same ones. They're all driven by the sun and the moon and the stars. And so there's surely a lot of overlap between the mechanisms that keep those clocks ticking and what they respond to. And so it strikes me that it's likely that just shifting to longer wavelengths, so reddish lights, instead of some of the awful full spectrum and blue lights that you see in many parts of the world. And perhaps most famously, this is true in Milan, where they basically replaced all of the lighting in the city centre with LEDs a few years ago. And you can see that from space now. Milan looks blue in the centre.
Wow.
It's just a rubbish idea.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the best answer, isn't it? Is to go back and think about the technology with this new, deeper understanding of biology in hand. And that's probably true for everything you've mentioned so far. So the electric light bulb, nobody really thought about biology when they invented that. You know, another good example is the lighting environment inside of buildings and windows in particular. Mm. It seems like everything has been designed around thermal efficiency without any consideration for biology whatsoever. And maybe now that the understanding of biology has caught up, that we should go back and rethink some of that.
Yeah, and buildings are really important. So just to touch on those, I think if we can design buildings such that we make better use of natural light, then that's going to be great, again, in terms of economy, but also with respect to workplace productivity. And we should only really be using artificial light when there isn't enough daylight available. And one of the frustrating things is that in some instances, our use of electric light is really strongly negatively affecting people. I think it's especially true of, say, hospitals.
Mm.
And there are also some quite simple things that we can do around buildings that can help support the function of our body's clocks too. So if, for example, you create light emitting structures, so lamps and so on, street lamps, that shine straight downwards, or use shields that block stray rays, focusing their light on areas where the light is needed and minimizing the dispersion of that light, then that's bound to be a good thing. But just to go back to hospitals, there has been some encouraging work recently looking at so-called human-centric lighting and ways of using lighting to support the function of our body's clocks. And in one study, they basically overhauled a hospital such that one part of the hospital had lighting that was much like the rest of it. And in another part of it, the light was rich in short wavelength light during the day. And then at night, it was substantially dimmer and depleted of those short wavelengths. And as a result, unsurprisingly, people fell asleep earlier, they slept slightly better, and they had lower sleepiness during the day too. And I think some of these changes could have some real effects on things like the health of people and healthcare costs too. There hasn't been that much research on this specifically, but I know that there have been a few studies looking at the intensive care unit, and specifically the neonatal intensive care unit, finding that if you compare children, infants that are kept in constant lighting, as is typical of many neonatal intensive care units, to infants that are given a light dark cycle. In this particular instance, it was a study that was done in Mexico, and the infants were given helmets to shield them from the light, which sounds strange and almost barbaric in a way, but they fared much better than the infants that were kept in constant light. They developed circadian rhythms, consolidated circadian rhythms in melatonin production more quickly. They were discharged from hospital sooner. They thrived better. So I think these are really important subjects to get right.
I can't resist asking, have you ever been approached by an architect or somebody with an interest in designing buildings to come in as a consultant and like present the biology as something that needs to be integrated into the design?
I have not, no. But I think it's on more people's radars nowadays.
Mm.
And I think we have to consider how we can make these stories as compelling as possible. So this might sound silly, but if you talk about something like the International Space Station, then many people's ears will perk up. And if you think about the International Space Station, then it circles Earth every hour and a half or so. And so astronauts on board will experience some pretty strange light-dark cycles relative to what they would get on the planet. And the space station's been overhauled. Space station, sound like Sean Connery there, has been overhauled to use some human-centric lighting in recent times. So they've got, I think, one light setting which produces a very bright white light, which is ideal during working hours. Another one that has a dim light, which is very depleted in those short wavelengths. And then another type of light too. And by introducing this new lighting system, they're able to sleep much better. And I think communicating examples like that with these people who are designing buildings, or people who don't know much about this subject, but realize this is something cool that's being done by the smart folks at NASA, can all of a sudden make it more intriguing to them. and make them think about how they might change their own built environments for the better.
Yeah, I do think about the idea of being in space as an excellent device for thinking about environmental mismatch in general. You know, I think it's kind of hard for people to get their head around. Yeah, like the subtle differences between, say, squatting and sitting in a chair, or being on the equator and being in the northern part of Finland. But then when you think about life on the International Space Station, you know, you remove gravity. Well, what does that do to human physiology? And the answer is a lot of things. And it's none of them are really very good, right?
Absolutely.
You touched on plants when talking about the effects of light on ecosystems. Is there anything more you'd like to say about that?
Yeah, not nearly as many studies have looked at the effects on plants. But in general, the ones that have suggest that light at night is bad news for plants too. And if you look, for example, at the UK, then there's been work looking at when trees open their buds each year and mapped that to satellite images of nighttime light. And they found that the light associated with the trees bursting their buds substantially earlier. And they compared that to what you would see with global warming, and the amount that the timing changed was equivalent to about a 2-degree increase in global warming. There's been some work looking at things like farm production of various different foods. So soybeans, for instance, and Chris, I know that you're not a massive fan of soybeans.
The soybeans, screw the soybeans. Like, they can, yeah. You just delete them. Along with the mosquitoes, you can delete them too.
But again, there's some work showing that the maturation of soybeans is quite strongly shifted by artificial light at night. And artificial light at night also reduces the yield of them, which you're probably chuffed about. And then again, the changes in plant biology will affect animals too. And this has been shown for many different animals, but quite a lot of the research has looked at certain insects in particular, finding that the numbers of them can drop, presumably because their food is less abundant.
Okay, so should we move on to some really practical things for the listener? What do you think?
Sure.
Let's talk about how our listeners should optimize their light environment, perhaps starting with light-emitting devices that we use on a regular basis. What do you think?
Okay, so historically people used incandescent lighting, and that's just a light bulb that has a wire filament that's heated until it glows, and that has some advantages. The bulbs are pretty cheap, they're quite easy to get rid of, they're eminently dimmable, and the spectrum is not that dissimilar from a sunset. And they also include some emissions that are outside of the visible range, so near infrared light, for instance. And some of those might actually be good for some aspects of our biology, such as the retinal cells that I mentioned earlier. But the disadvantage of these old light bulbs is that they're quite energy hungry. And as a result of that, many countries have practically done away with them in recent years. I think 2009, the European Commission started withdrawing them, and many countries have just followed suit. And to be honest, I think that was a big mistake. And that's in part because of what they've been replaced by. So some people use compact fluorescent lights. They're definitely bad news. They can be quite hazardous because they contain mercury, which is a neurotoxin, of course. There aren't really any good protocols for how to get rid of them. And a lot of them just get thrown into landfill. And obviously, given the mercury content, that's not a good idea. And then UV light can escape from them, and that can be bad for certain cells in your body. And I think the US FDA actually recommends not using them more than a certain amount each day. And their spectra are also quite different from natural light. They often flicker, and that can trigger things like headaches. And they're not as energy efficient as many people think they are. So I think we should practically write those off. And then light emitting diodes, LEDs, are obviously really widely used nowadays. They've definitely got some advantages. They don't contain mercury or some other heavy metals that are present in other types of lights. They don't produce much UV radiation, which could be damaging. And they're quite energy efficient. They last longer than the compact fluorescent lights too, but they're not very dimmable, and they're not so good at rendering different colors either. And they also have quite different spectra from natural lighting. And again, they're quite tricky to get rid of. And one of the interesting things about LEDs is that it's become increasingly clear over time that they might influence some other devices. So some of their electromagnetic radiation seems to affect things like mobile phones and possibly even some medical equipment, hearing aids, implantable cardiovascular devices, pacemakers, that type of thing. So they're a bit of a mixed bag. So with that said, I think what we should be aiming for is that type of human-centric lighting that I mentioned previously. And practically, I think that means that during the daytime, we need to spend as much time outdoors as possible. But if you're indoors, then you want to favor overhead lighting, and it should be polychromatic white light, which is rich in short wavelengths. And returning to that PLOS consensus paper that I mentioned near the start of the conversation, they actually give some specific numbers. They recommend a minimum melanopic EDI of 250 lux, which is higher than that in terms of photopic lux. It's probably more like 500 lux or so. But I think practically sit by windows when you get the opportunity if you're indoors. Phyllis has done some nice work comparing office workers with windows to those without, finding that the ones that sit by windows, unsurprisingly, get more light exposure, but they also probably slightly more physically active. They get more sleep and they feel better. And if you sit by windows, you don't need to use electric lighting as much, so you're going to save energy too. And then I think in the evening, as a rule of thumb, if you can start to modify your light environment beginning about 3 hours before your planned bedtime, then that's probably the sweet spot based on that consensus statement by the world's leading experts on the subject. And I think if you can use incandescent lights or warm white LEDs, then that's probably your best bet. And you want your lighting to be indirect if possible. As I mentioned at the start, the lower the lights, the better relative to the level of your eyes. I mentioned warm white there. What I mean by that is the color temperature, which is kind of a strange term, but if the color temperature is below about 3000 Kelvin, then that's probably going to suit you quite well. And the idea is just that you want as little blue light in the spectrum as possible. And then obviously when you're in bed or when you're planning to sleep, you want to minimize your exposure to all types of light. And as I mentioned before, always go for red in bed if possible. And then the final thing that I'll just mention here is different light emitting devices. There's been some interesting new technology. So people are looking at different ways of making computers and TVs that reduces the degree to which the screens stimulate those intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells. And conventional displays, they use a few different colors of light, red, green, and blue, but you can use a phenomenon named metamerism to combine light in different ways that produce the same appearance, but the spectrum of light that makes up the what you see is quite different. And as a result, you can thereby affect things like how alert people are, their sleep propensity, and so on. And Robert Lucas from Manchester has done some nice work on this, finding that if you use that approach, then the people who look at the screens might not be able to tell the difference between them. But if they use them at night, then using these modified displays, they feel more sleepy, they produce more melatonin, and as a result, they're likely to sleep better. And then obviously, there are lots of different types of software now that can reduce your exposure to short wavelengths too. And I think if you have an iPhone, there's no harm in using night shift mode. If you use an Android device, then I would use the equivalent night mode. And the same is true for software such as f.lux, which I'm sure you use, Chris. I've used it for years. And using these types of software definitely does reduce the amount of short wavelength light that's emitted by screens. And there's been some research by people such as Deborah Skeen at the University of Surrey showing that to be true. The problem is that some people just don't like those apps. And Nicholas Allen, who's at the University of Oregon, did some work last year showing this, took young people, so typical university students who were using their smartphones and laptops around bedtime, had them download f.lux, and everyone thought they had the active product, but the software was only activated in half the people. The problem was that the participants didn't actually really experience any changes to their sleep, whether measured objectively or subjectively. And they found that the software was annoying, so they quite often just disabled it because they weren't used to it. And again, if you're spending lots of time outdoors during the day, then I think these different software programs are only going to have quite modest effects, if any effects at all. However, I just don't see any downside to using them, assuming that you don't find them frustrating. And then just related to that, if you do want to use blue blockers, then there's quite a lot of research on them now. And there is some research suggesting that if you wear them consistently, then you're probably going to synthesize a bit more melatonin. You might sleep slightly longer and your sleep quality might improve a little bit too. Some people who study this stuff don't like them because they tend to shy away from purposely depleting what you see of certain wavelengths of light based on some hypotheses that that might not be good for vision in the long term. But I haven't seen any compelling data showing that to be true. And so personally, while I don't use them, I wouldn't have any issue with people trying blue blockers for a couple of hours before bed. If I was going to use them myself, I'd probably only use them in the context of jet lag though.
Yeah. I must admit, I have not used them in a very long time. It's just like one of those things, you know, how long are you going to keep this up? Are you really going to wear those? I don't think so. And what I said earlier about your sleep is only as good as your kids. I'm not going to get my kids to wear blue blockers, right? Like, just, yeah, I no. But what you're saying, I think, is that if you spend enough time outdoors during the day, then all this light at night stuff from the devices becomes less important. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's something at least we got. I also think, you know, going back to some of what you said, that perhaps we've been fiddling in the margins with respect to power saving in some areas. Like, so when you look at how much power an incandescent bulb uses, say 60 watts is a pretty bright one. Well, that's still nothing compared to anything with a heating element, right? Like, look how much power your tumble dryer uses, for example. Like, It seems like we're fiddling in them versus drying your clothes outside, that nobody does in the US. It's like people think you're weird or poor or something if you dry your clothes outside in the US, even in California.
Yeah. So
it's just, you're fiddling in the margins, but then sometimes you're not, right? So the thermal efficiency associated with glass, having worked for big tech companies in Silicon Valley, they have metal boxes with glass that's very efficient, thermally efficient, right? Because they're thinking about how much it's going to cost to air condition the building. So now we're talking about big energy savings, I think, although I don't really know. And having everybody sit by a window is kind of impractical. You know, if you're going to bring everyone together into one space, then surely not everyone is going to be able to sit next to a window. So do you think, I mean, obviously there's practical concerns here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are lots of different ways to modify people's light environments too. So if you think, for example, that many different surfaces reflect light, and that you can model some of those reflections, then it could be that even if not everyone can sit by windows, you can construct the building such that the light scatters in a certain way and that over time everyone benefits.
Do you have any specific recommendations for shift workers? I know you're published on this area, so it's a loaded question.
Yeah, published on that area, but it's a really hard thing to get right. And so my answer will actually be very brief. And I think as an individual, there are a few different things that you might want to do. One is just keep a high intensity portable light handy when you need a boost in how alert you feel and you need to be able to focus at work. And there are small lights that you can keep by your desk or your workstation. You could, for instance, use a light therapy lamp if you want. The trade-off here is that while you will get that short-term boost in mood and cognition, you will also influence your body's clock. And so I think the future is using different types of closed loop devices that take some information about your body's clock and your future shift schedule and your light environment and so on, and use that information to modify the light you're exposed to at the level of the eye. That's a separate subject for a separate time. And then I think if you can keep some blue blockers helpful, handy, then that might be helpful. You could, for instance, just pop those on beginning a couple of hours before sleep. This is definitely one instance where I think they can be handy. And one other thing that I'll mention is that if you're struggling to adapt to your shift, then bear in mind that when you're exposed to light and when you exercise can additively shift your body's clock. Mm-hmm. And so in general, say that you're trying to shift your clock later to adjust to a night shift. And the way that you would do that through your light exposure is to expose yourself to lots of high intensity, short wavelength, rich light around when you would habitually go to sleep. If you do some exercise around that time too, then you probably shift your clock more than you would just through the light exposure alone. And so if you can break up your shifts with periods of activity, then you might help yourself adjust to them. And you'll probably also support your cardiometabolic health.
Okay, thank you. That's great. Finally, do you think there's anything else that we've missed that is worth mentioning?
Yeah, I'll mention a couple of things. One is jet lag. And just a quick tip that I learned from Simon Marshall that I'm sure I mentioned previously is there's a website that's free named jetlagrooster.com where you can go and you can plug in information about where you're flying from and to and whether you want to shift your clock in advance, etc. And it will just give you some personalized guidance based on when to expose yourself to light, when to avoid light exposure, whether it makes sense to use melatonin, etc. Mm. And we'll give you a plan to help speed the rate at which you adjust the new time zone. And I think in that context, again, sunglasses and or blue blockers can be helpful, and syncing your physical activity with times at which jet lag rooster suggests that you get lots of light exposure will also potentially speed the rate at which you adjust the new time zone. Mm-hmm. I think with respect to seasonal affective disorder, if you suffer from that, then most guidance nowadays suggests that using a light therapy lamp that emits maybe 2,500 to 10,000 lux for 30 to 60 minutes each day at the same time every day, often the morning works well for people, is likely to help lift your mood during those dark months, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think that you need to bear in mind what you're optimizing for. So going back to something that we spoke about at the start, there are trade-offs here at play. So yes, maybe getting lots of daylight is good for the function of your body's clock and for your metabolism and for your endocrine status. However, it could be that it's not so good for your macular health. And you therefore just need to bear that in mind with respect to your own biology and what you personally struggle with. And Chris, I think that you're quite anti-sun cream. I'm probably less anti-sun cream. And obviously, sun creams exist on a vast spectrum from probably very endocrinologically problematic to much more benign. But if you are very fair, say that you've got bright red hair and you've barely got any melanin in your skin, then you're going to be someone that probably wants to think carefully about going on holiday to a hot country and your use of sun cream and so on. And then there's also the whole world of esoterica that we could get into, the photobiomodulation and gamma wave entrainment and some of those sexy things, which require a lot more research, but I think do have some potential. But we will leave that for another time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would again refer people to Highlights 15. I've nothing against zinc oxide sun protection, but I just don't think it's a very good tool for the job, right? I mean, ideally, you would build up tolerance gradually, as I said earlier, and then just cover up, put something on, put a hat on, put a shirt on. You don't need to put some chemical thing all over your body.
Yeah, but I mean, going back to mismatch, me being from Northern European ancestry, if I went and tried to live in Saudi Arabia, my biology is not well suited to that environmental niche. And so maybe that's a case in which I need some additional help. And like you say, I think using some sort of physical barrier, so zinc oxide as opposed to chemical sunscreen, makes a lot of sense.
Uh-huh. Well, one final question. Where can people find you online? Are you still active on social media anywhere? Are there any other podcasts that you're either planning or have done recently that we should listen to? Are there any other books or anything else that you've enjoyed? I know you're a voracious consumer of knowledge, and I would love it if you could share some of that with us now.
Okay. Yeah, still on social media, at Greg Potter PhD, post periodically, mostly on Instagram. I've recently ventured into the world of TikTok, which is probably a terrible idea, but just giving it a go. Why not? A little self-experiment. And my website is gregpotterphd.com. With respect to knowledge and things that I've come across recently, Chris, we had a brief back and forth about Robert Stickgold's new book, When Brains Dream, which is well worth a read. I should also give credit to his co-author, Antonio Zadra. And then otherwise, a book recommendation, which isn't so related to the things I normally speak about, which I love. It's not perfect by any means, but it's a brilliant book, is The Beginning of Infinity by David Deutsch.
Oh, I've read that.
Yeah, which is basically about the infinite reach of knowledge and the fact that problems are soluble and really it's knowledge that limits us. And one other book recommendation I'll give that I finished recently and I think is terrific, quite concerning, but also hopeful, is The Precipice by Toby Ord, which is mostly about existential risks, what's most important to consider from a long-term perspective, and how each of us can help mitigate some of those, depending on the types of careers that we want to consider. Definitely worth a read.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll definitely check those two out. And are you available for hire at all, like personal consultations, if I can't sleep or I'm trying to optimize my daily light environment? Is that something you can help me with as an individual or a corporation?
Yes. Yeah, both of the above. As you can tell, I'm not a salesperson.
It's just as well I'm here.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Excellent. So just the usual contacts that you mentioned already.
Yeah, just reach out via my website if that's the case.
Okay. Well, Greg, this has been fantastic as always. Very technical, but very useful, very practical, I think, too. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate the depth and the time that you put into preparing for these podcasts. So thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Pleasure. Thanks, Chris.